The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, The Tweener Crowd. Early stage investments led by Robbie Allen and Scott Wingo are helping fill the capital gap among entrepreneurs, but much work is needed for a healthy ecosystem. And the cover story article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, Filling the Capital Void. About 150 investors have bought into Scott Wingo's vision to invest in dozens of local startups, an important step to address the area's lack of early-stage capital. And this is written by Lauren Onasorge. When your bank collapses and your payroll is in danger, who do you call? In those panic moments when Silicon Valley Bank fell, Cara Borenstein, CEO of Durham's StashPad, didn't even have to dial the digits. That's because Scott Wingo, founder of the Triangle Tweener Fund, was already reaching out, having seen the email she sent to investors, letting them know what was happening. When Borenstein looked to change the pricing model a month and a half ago, Wingo was waiting with a whiteboard. Tina Tang, co-founder of do-it-yourself app startup Bristle, says Wingo is always just a phone call away. This being our first startup, he's just cut the learning curve in so many ways when it comes to different things we run into as first-time entrepreneurs, Tang says. And they're not alone in cheerleading the Tweener Fund and its serial entrepreneur founder. On a random weekday, it's not unusual to see Wingo, often with his partner Robbie Allen, sitting at the Page Road Starbucks, science fiction puns at the ready. Wingo is best known for being the entrepreneur behind firms such as Channel Advisor and Get Spiffy. But over the past year and a half, he's also the man responding to the bat signal sent out by early stage entrepreneurs such as Borenstein and Tang, who need both cash and advice. Backed by about 150 investors, the Tweener Fund is investing in dozens of startups with little due diligence required. It's moving at such a fast clip that it's being recognized as one of the most active venture capital firms in existence. PitchBook recently named Tweener Fund the most active venture capital firm in the Southeast, despite the fact that it, too, is a startup with its soft launch at the end of 2021. Allen, who left Cisco to start what would become Automated Insights, joined Wingo, first as a limited partner, an LP, then as a partner last year. Together, they're running the Rolling Fund, filling a gap and saving the day for startups, many of which just need a fraction of the Series A raises their counterparts are making headlines for getting in California. It's an important move in the triangle where entrepreneurs often find it difficult to raise funds. Startups are a risky business, something limited partners know all too well. Frank McIntyre, a Tweener Fund LP, estimates that out of every 50 startups, just one is the lucky winner when it comes to investor returns. But he's investing anyway, in part because of the fund's approach. Instead of funneling millions into a handful of big bets, it's using an index strategy, writing dozens of small checks to many companies at once using a set tweener criteria instead of personal objectivity. It's rolling the dice with small bets and counting on the fact that even when it backs horses instead of unicorns, there'll be enough of a spread to keep it in the black. The $5,000 minimum commitment per quarter won't break the bank for its investors, lessening the pressure first-time LPs feel when writing the checks. McIntyre and his fellow LPs believe this could be the Tweener Fund's moment for many of the reasons some think the entrepreneurship ecosystem is in danger. How it started. Wingo compiled what he called the Tweener List in 2015, an exhaustive inventory of Triangle Tech startups with either a minimum of $1 million a year in sales or 10 employees. Under his definition, companies graduate when they pass the $80 million per year in revenue mark or 500 employees benchmark. Wingo describes them as the Goldilocks companies, not too small and not too large. He started the list trying to pay it forward, he says. Wingo founded his first company at age 27 and credits his success to seasoned mentors such as Triangle serial entrepreneurs Chris Evans and Richard Holcomb. Year by year, he updated the list, adding more and more names. He noticed trends from exits to investments. A few years went by and, says Wingo, I now have 7 years of really good data. At the same time, he was investing in startups, including as an LP of venture capital firms, and he started to wonder how he could turn the data into an investment thesis. By this point, Wingo had been on both sides of the pitch table. As an LP, he knew the formula venture capitalists would outline. Traditional players would invest in 15 companies over 5 years with the expectation that a third of them would mean zero returns. Another third would return the money and a little bit extra. And a third would be one or two home runs, and that will return the fund, Wingo says. It's this power law dynamic. You can narrow it down to just these companies, and that basically drives all the returns, he says. At the same time, VCs had been raising their minimums. Allen, who has also been an LP, recalls how 7 years ago, the minimum investment at one local player was $200,000. Today, it's between $350,000 to $400,000, he says. Wingo says it can be prohibitive for some of the existing entrepreneurs who might want to invest back into the ecosystem. If you're new to that, that's a big number, he says, and it's a big number for just a handful of successes, he adds. Wingo was thinking about that as he looked at the data he compiled for the tweener list. There are almost no failures, he says, estimating about two companies a year fizzle with a slight spike in 2020. I kind of stumbled on this really nice signal that once a company gets to a million run rate, the failure rate goes way down. Wingo attributes it to product market fit, a code startups typically have to crack in order to cross the $1 million mark. And it came together to be the backbone of the idea that would become the Tweener Fund. Wingo had created an index with the Tweener list, so why not an index fund? Smaller check sizes wouldn't just allow more accredited investors access, but would also allow the firm to do more deals, instead of funneling big money to just a handful of firms. The Tweener Fund would write small checks to a lot of companies, putting Wingo's tweener theory to the test. The fund relies on its co-investors, players writing bigger checks to do much of the due diligence. We don't do a lot of due diligence because if you can get however many customers to write you checks so that it's $80,000 a month, customers are comfortable investing their money. We're comfortable investing ours, he says. We're trying to invest in as many of these tweeners to build this index of Triangle tweener companies. Wingo says that when there are losses, the portfolio theory will minimize the impact. The firm only invests in Triangle companies, and that's really resonated with investors, Wingo says. For startups, they get a mentor, but only if they need one. Our pitch is, it's fast, easy money, Allen says. We're not going to bother you. We don't want you to be on your board. We don't want to be on your board, but we want to give you a bat phone, a lifeline if you get stuck, says Wingo, adding that the firm has 150 LPs behind it, which means a slew of seasoned experts who can answer questions. By keeping the minimum investments low at $5,000 a quarter for accredited investors, the Tweener Fund can fill its pool of LPs with active executives and entrepreneurs, not just retired CEOs. And that's what's happened. The firm made its soft launch at the end of 2021. By January 1, it had $600,000, three times what Wingo had set out to compile, and that meant more portfolio possibilities. Last year was about figuring out the cadence. This year, with talk of downturns and interest rate hikes, they didn't know what to expect when it came to LP renewals. Allen anticipated some churn in LPs come January. But the firm actually gained investors in the quarter. So we're feeling really bullish about the model, he says. What LPs are saying. The limited partners say a combination of the price point and Wingo and Allen's startup history had them writing checks. Eva Garland, CEO of Eva Garland Consulting, read about the fund and talked through its objectives with Wingo. She quickly signed on. McIntyre, who already knew Wingo through his work in the ecosystem, liked the concept and signed on too. Having a big spread at the earliest stage makes more sense mathematically, and it gives you the ability and the option to focus on where you can concentrate, he says. The most successful companies rise to the top. Other entrepreneurs turned LP say they were trying to up their own stakes in the ecosystem, such as Abhi Narang. It was Wingo who inspired his current passion, investing. Scott helps everybody, he says. Gradually, Narang made bets on Wingo, first by investing in Spiffy through Venture South. Then by becoming a tweener LP, and through the tweener fund, he can broaden his impact, he says. It's very quick, Narang says. It's not standard at all. Marlena Bunn, a Triangle native, met Wingo at a prior company servicing his HR and payroll benefits. The two stayed in touch. She had been wanting to get involved in the ecosystem and the tweener fund's price point fit. You don't have to put in your life savings, she says. It's an easy way to get started without tapping into college funds. Garland says the timing of the fund was particularly enticing as it came at the tail end of COVID. The entrepreneurial ecosystem has always relied on connections, and COVID made it very hard for these connections to naturally continue, Garland says. With Tweener Fund, Wingo and Allen are creating an extraordinary network of individuals and expertise just when the ecosystem needed it the most, she says. And a network is what Wingo and Allen are ultimately creating. Wingo, an e-commerce executive at heart, says the firm operates with a two-sided marketplace. On one side, it has investors. On the other, it has its portfolio companies. Investors and founders are looking for more. They want content, and they want to meet each other. This year, we're figuring that out, Wingo says. Right now, the firm is pushing out about $800,000 a quarter. It's a rolling fund, and the goal is to invest as much of the commitments as possible in the same quarter. And that means Tweener Fund is hungry for potential portfolio firms. Wingo says he and Allen are in constant communication with their networks and scouring news articles. If anyone writes about a startup, we want to know them, he says. We want to track them down. Startup Champion. That's what happened with Bristles. Wingo saw a profile written about the company, which helps do-it-yourselfers visualize home improvements, and reached out to Tang. They met at the Page Road Starbucks, and Tang showed Wingo a demo of an early version of the product. She kept him in the loop, and he asked her if Tweener Fund could invest. In addition to frequent emails, Tang and Wingo meet in person at least every couple of months. He's just the best champion and mentor and advisor for us, Tang says. Similarly, Borenstein says Wingo reached out with an invite to the same Starbucks. The pair talked about StashPad, a note-taking app, and she kept him updated on the firm's progress, which resulted in an offer to invest. Both Tang and Borenstein says it was a conversation, not a competition for funds. And that's what Wingo says he's going for, the opposite of the Simon Cowell approach. By using an index fund strategy, he and Allen take their own personal opinions out of the mix. It's a strategy based on experience, in part from a crazy idea he rejected out of an NC State University professor a few years ago. This guy was going to use an ant algorithm for robots. I'm not going to invest in this, he remembers thinking after the pitch. That company, Kiva, was later acquired by Amazon for $775 million. What I've learned through that and channel advisor is you can't pick the winners, Wingo says. It's not our job to tell you your company won't succeed. With us, our default answer isn't a no, it's a yes. But what about bad actors? Recent headlines, such as those surrounding the now-imprisoned Elizabeth Holmes, who made misrepresentations about her California company, Theranos, defrauding both customers and investors in the process, have some players increasing their scrutiny on portfolio firms. But not Tweener Fund. A bad actor is going to get around due diligence anyway, Wingo says. That's not to say they give the green light to everything. Wingo says that if both he and Allen feel their spidey senses tingle, they'll walk away. But they both know what it is like to pitch, able to empathize with that in the way a lot of VCs can't, Allen says. Wingo still remembers his first pitch to Scott Albert, then with Aurora Fund Partners. He was very nice. It was very nice, he says. But it was a solid no. Wingo remembers being told that every investment we make has to return the whole fund, and we don't think this will do that. 2023 and fundraising. The fundraising market for startups is less than ideal. Global funding in the first quarter reached $76 billion, a 53% decline from the $162 billion doled out in the first quarter of 2022, according to Crunchbase. It's created a gap for smaller players, such as Triangle Tweener Fund, and Allen says it's planning on taking full advantage. Tweener Fund made 12 investments in the first quarter, including in 10 new portfolio companies. But as per its thesis, the check sizes were small, averaging just over $56,000, part of average round sizes at $2.6 million. Allen sees venture capital as a whole coming back. There's a whole bunch of money sitting on the sidelines, he says. By 2024, they'll have to start investing it. But for now, larger VCs are writing fewer checks. Their due diligence is taking longer, at times too long, to save a startup, and that means players with quicker turnarounds are critical as a bridge. But Wingo believes microfunds have a growing place in entrepreneurship, even when big capital returns. And that's because with the rise of artificial intelligence, there's a real question of, will companies in the future need as much capital? Wingo points to Channel Advisor, which needed more than $90 million to build a $100 million company. Much of that cash went into servers. With cloud, you can chop that in half, he says. Add in AI, and Wingo notes, Do you really need that many salespeople, legal people? Maybe you only need $10 million or $20 million to build that $100 million company. Maybe the whole venture model is going to have to change because companies are going to raise a lot less, Wingo says. As for the region's other investors, they say there is plenty of room for the tweener fund. If you look at it historically, over 80% of the capital still comes from firms outside of the area, says Jason Kaplan, co-founder of Bull City Venture Partners. It's validation that we need more dollars. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The South dominates. New numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau detail just how much growth in the South is outpacing the rest of the country. Federal numbers show there were 1.631 million new privately owned housing units that were started in the month of May. Those numbers are seasonally adjusted. What's astonishing, though, is that more than half of those were in the South, 908,000. That's far more than the densely populated Northeast, with a mere 100,000 housing units started. The Midwest had 282,000 for May, and the West, 341,000. It was the same pattern in May 2021, indicating that the pandemic shift to the warmer climate of the South is continuing. In May 2021, there were 1.543 million privately owned new housing starts, and 851,000 of those were in the South. The Census Bureau's definition of the South goes from Texas to Maryland and even Delaware. Given the growth of the region, it's worth noting that four of the most populated states, number two, Texas at 30 million. Number three, Florida at 22.2 million. Number eight, Georgia at 10.9 million. And number nine, North Carolina at 10.7 million are in the South. Bojangles weighs major change to brand. Bojangles, a North Carolina favorite based in Charlotte, wants to ditch the chicken business. The brand already dropped the famous chicken and biscuits slogan from its name in 2020 and is pivoting towards a new strategy. This is going to sound weird or controversial, CEO Jose Amario told QSR Magazine, but I'd like to get out of the chicken business. I want to get into the experience business. Amario is testing a new concept at six locations, none in the Carolinas, that feature shaved-down menus with no bone-in chicken, grits, or mashed potatoes and gravy. Instead, they offer a new hand-breaded chicken tender, milkshakes including a bowberry flavor, cold brew coffee, and premium salads. Amario wants the business to become a national powerhouse brand and has plans to keep expanding this year, including entering the Texas market. So people will know the brand, but we're really sort of launching the brand in a more modern, contemporary way, he told the magazine. This sounds a bit like New Coke to Biz, right? North Carolina sends another to D.C. The list of federal agency leaders with ties to North Carolina continues to grow. President Joe Biden has tapped Mandy Cohen to be the next director for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. While not a native to North Carolina, Cohen led the state's public health response to the pandemic as head of the state's Department of Health and Human Services. After serving in this role from 2017 to 2021, Cohen joined healthcare company Aledade to lead a new health services unit headquartered in Durham. Also in Washington is Dr. Robert Califf, who held numerous roles at Duke University, including serving as the founding director of the Duke Clinical Research Institute. He became commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in early 2022. Califf is in his second stint as FDA commissioner. Meanwhile, Michael Regan, a native of Goldsboro, joined Biden's administration as head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Regan stepped into the role in March 2021 after previously serving as secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. New boutique hotel rises. Here at Biz, we're always on the lookout for fun places to explore, and a hotel company that specializes in cool properties has a new target, Blowing Rock. Hay Creek Hotels will soon open The Embers, a 36-room boutique hotel in the central part of the charming town in the North Carolina mountains. Hay Creek features properties across the U.S., including places such as Kennebunkport, Maine, and Charleston, South Carolina. This is Hay Creek Hotel's first foray into North Carolina. Norman McLeod, who grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, founded the company in 2005. It's based in Exeter, New Hampshire. Clean water effort is subject of film. A former Raleigh bartender's effort to provide safe drinking water for impoverished countries is the subject of a new documentary. Doc Henley launched Wine to Water in 2004, back when he was bartending and playing music in Raleigh clubs. He first raised money to help install water systems in Sudan. The nonprofit, now based in Boone, has expanded its scope across the globe and reported revenue of roughly $3 million for the fiscal year that ended June 30, 2021. A new documentary, Beyond Water, detailed the efforts supported by corporate partner Lenovo in a screening June 22nd at the IMAX Theater in Raleigh. And finally, intense demand for apartments. Raleigh is the 10th most in-demand city for renters, according to a new report released by Rent Cafe. Rent Cafe tracks availability rates, page views, favorites, and saved searches on its apartment listing website. Listing views increased by 14% from June 2022, and the number of apartments that were favorited by users tripled from last year. And now we turn to our top news story in the Triangle Business Journal. This one written by Kaylee Thompson. The headline, Shaw wins approval for high-rise development. The controversial rezoning for 26 acres at Shaw University has been approved, clearing the way for up to 20 and 30 stories of development on the campus of the historically black school in downtown Raleigh. The university is seeking new revenue streams, and school officials think commercial development could play a major role in Shaw's financial future, given its prime location in a fast-growing city that's seeing billions of dollars worth of new investment. In a split vote, the Raleigh City Council on June 20 approved the rezoning request 5-3, with council members Mary Black, Christina Jones, and Megan Patton opposed. The new rezoning, which comes with conditions, allows office mixed use up to 3 stories for some parcels and downtown mixed use up to 12, 20, and 30 stories on others. It also removes the partial Prince Hall Historic Overlay District and South Park Neighborhood Conservation Overlay District. The rezoned land includes 17 parcels on East South Street, South Blunt Street, Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, East Lenore Street, South Person Street, and South Wilmington Street. The university is surrounded by residential zoning and downtown mixed use, with height allowances varying from 3 to 40 stories. Kevin Sullivan, the university's vice president for real estate and strategic development, previously told Triangle Business Journal that the university isn't looking to sell off property. Instead, Shaw is looking to lease land to developers for projects that complement the university, its students, and the surrounding community. And in a section called A Closer Look, several conditions are attached to the new zoning. Estee Hall, Tupper Memorial Hall, Leonard Hall, and Tyler Hall are required to be preserved in place. The Rogers Bagley, Daniels Pegues House, and Charles Fraser House must remain in place or be relocated. If they have to be relocated, an archaeological survey must be conducted. Student housing must be built within the first 3 new buildings, and there must be at least 100 beds, and housing can't be rented at a higher price than the average of other universities in the city. Public meetings must occur to update the community about ongoing development for 3 years after the first site plan is submitted. Conditions are tied to the future sale of university property, and other conditions address certain uses, parking, and infrastructure. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the reporter pages, and we start with Lauren Onosorge's page on aviation and tech. Breeze has big plans for RDU expansion. New airline will look at international options as it grows. Could Breeze Airways go international at Raleigh-Durham International Airport? Maybe, says CEO David Neilman. In town this month, announcing the firm's 10th and 11th flights out of RDU to Las Vegas and Tampa, Florida. This is a vibrant area, says Neilman, when asked why Breeze keeps investing in the market. Neilman says the airline is working to get federal approval for international flights and that RDU would absolutely be on the short list once Breeze Airways has permission to fly abroad. Neilman expects to target international leisure markets such as locations in the Caribbean and Mexico. He says there are no concrete plans, but he envisions serving areas with inclusive resorts, places like Punta Cana and Cancun. Breeze could also someday base a crew at RDU. Right now, crews just pass through the airport based elsewhere. I will tell you that of all the cities we've announced, Raleigh is the one of the fastest starts we've ever had, Neilman says. Breeze, which launched in 2021, is based in Utah, announced plans to come to RDU in November with 3 flights initially, Hartford, Connecticut, New Orleans, and Providence, Rhode Island. The airline began service at RDU earlier this year. Dancer turned VC joins Idea Fund Partners. The Triangle's newest venture capitalist is searching for the next unicorn. Zakia Alta Lee, new senior associate at Idea Fund Partners, is unique, a woman in a sector long dominated by men, and she plans to leverage her perspective as an asset both for the firm and the Triangle. My goal is to find the best entrepreneurs and the best companies, hands down, she says. But I think as a woman, there is an untapped space in the market for both women and underrepresented groups. So I'm excited. I feel as a woman at IDEA, I'm going to be able to have the eye to help spot and forge those type of deals. Lee, a former National Basketball Association dancer and entrepreneur, says she's looking for founders who are solving a problem they themselves experienced. For me, when you recognize a problem and you set out and start a company to solve that problem, that tells me that there is a pain point there, she says, adding that she's interested in pain medicine, not vitamins. We're looking for what is going to be that pain medicine, Lee says. Nobody gets up at 2 a.m. and gets a vitamin, but they will go to the store and get that Tylenol if it's bad enough. Her advice? Make sure your pitch deck is solid and shows the total addressable market for your product, as well as how you're going to disrupt that sector. An initial meeting with Lee likely happens via a quick Zoom call. Their excitement around the startup, that makes me want to have that additional meeting in person, she says. And finally, Triangle Startup Inc.'s D.R. Horton deal. Affordable homes built out of grass. It's about to become a reality thanks to a Triangle startup and a new partnership. Plant D, which recently moved into an 80,000-square-foot production facility in Oxford, makes construction materials derived from grass, and it just signed its first major partnership with D.R. Horton. Co-founder Josh Dorfman calls the deal validating for materials his firm is developing as an alternative to wood. We're in a fortunate position where it's not build it and hopefully they will come, he says. In this respect, they've come and they've said, here's an order. We know where those first products are going, and we know there's now a path to make sure they're going into homes. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page written by Zach Ezone. Talent Pipeline sparks a major investment. United Therapeutics to expand an RDP with $500 million project. A multi-billion dollar company is doubling down on North Carolina with a $500 million investment. When considering its options for a new critical drug manufacturing facility, United Therapeutics looked to Research Triangle Park, where the company has access to a talented workforce and the ability to leverage its existing operations. The facility will add to United's already substantial footprint on TW Alexander Drive, where the company owns a 380,000-square-foot building with manufacturing and office space. The site serves as one of United's headquarters, with the other in Maryland. Adjacent to this facility, the company owns a 170-acre site that features roughly 217,000 square feet of building space that's used for research, development, and other purposes. This existing footprint will allow United Therapeutics to move quickly in obtaining the permits to move forward with the new manufacturing facility, which was a key factor when considering potential sites, says Dewey Stedman, head of investor relations for the company. The ability to move quickly is as important as the facility will be used to expand the company's capacity to produce Tyvaso DPI, a drug-device combination product that received approval by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration last year. Tyvaso DPI, and that's spelled T-Y-V-A-S-O DPI, is a central part of United's growth strategy as it aims to double its revenue in the coming years. The company is bullish on the existing and anticipated future demand for the product. That's the reason why we need to start now deploying a substantial amount of capital to build this brand new Tyvaso DPI production facility in Research Triangle Park, company CEO Martine Rothblatt said during a May earnings call. Access to the Triangle's workforce was also a key factor in the company's decision to build the facility in RTP. While United hasn't disclosed how many employees it will hire for the new facility, it already employs about 460 workers in North Carolina, nearly half of United's employee base. RTP Pharma Alcami names new CEO. Alcami, a contract development and manufacturing organization with operations in Wilmington and Research Triangle Park, has a new CEO amid a flurry of management changes. Alcami announced June 5 the retirement of former CEO Patrick Walsh and the appointment of Bill Humphreys as the new CEO, Walsh will remain as the chair of its board of directors. Humphreys has filled leadership roles at various life sciences companies, including CEO of Isosceles Pharmaceuticals and CEO of MERS North America in Raleigh. Humphreys is also a board member at Bryn Pharma. In March, Alkami named Jamie Iudica chief manufacturing officer. In this role, Iudica assumed the responsibilities of retiring COO Ken Domogalski. Alkami also announced the retirement of Chief Financial Officer Eric Evans and the promotion of Ken Morgan to fill the position. And finally, pharma company cuts 81 Raleigh jobs. A pharmaceutical firm is laying off 81 employees at its facility in Raleigh as the industry continues to shed jobs. Sagent Pharmaceuticals, that's spelled S-A-G-E-N-T, informed state officials on June 12 of the workforce reduction at its manufacturing facility at 8900 Capitol Boulevard. Sagent expects the job cuts to begin on August 11 to be permanent, according to the WARN notice it filed with the North Carolina Department of Commerce. The Sagent layoffs come a few years after the Illinois company took over the Raleigh facility. In 2019, Sagent acquired the facility from Xellia Pharmaceuticals through a deal that represented a significant milestone for Sagent, CEO Peter Kammerer said at the time. The WARN notice doesn't cite a reason for the reduction, but it comes a few months after Sagent's former parent company, Nichio Iko Pharmaceutical of Japan, disclosed it was selling Sagent and Canada's Omega Laboratories to Elemist Singapore PTE of Singapore. Nichio Iko decided to exit North America to establish a firm earning structure and fundamentally improve the company's financial condition, according to a February statement. During the fiscal year that ended March 2022, Sagent had an operating loss of $243 million. At the time it announced the sale, Nichi Iko said the final transfer price would be decided after implementing a price adjustment based on a combined enterprise value of $100 million for both Sagent and Omega. Nichi Iko expected to accrue a share transfer loss of $124 million in connection to the sale. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Brumette. Mommy Nora's location sold to Cookout. Thomasville company often buys property as an investment. An affiliate of a popular North Carolina fast food chain has scooped up property in Raleigh, though it might not be for a new drive-through location. Cookout recently purchased a parcel of land on Wake Forest Road that is home to Mommy Nora's, a popular restaurant serving Latin-style rotisserie chicken. The purchase was made by Cookout Zebulon Incorporated. The entity, along with a few others of similar names, is also is known as the company's real estate investment arm. The property is located at 2401 Wake Forest Road beside the McNeil Point Shopping Center. Mommy Nora's has occupied the main building on the site since 2010. A second, smaller building sits at the back of the property with the address of 2403 Wake Forest Road, though it appears to be abandoned. The sale occurred in March for a price of $2.95 million. Palm Real Estate Holdings was the previous owner. Cookout officials could not be reached for comment, but the Thomasville company has a habit of buying properties across North Carolina as investments instead of development opportunities. In January, the company bought the Rockin' Comet restaurant in Clayton. At the time, Cookout CEO Jeremy Reeves said, "That location is staying, Rockin' Comet." Reeves previously told the Winston-Salem Journal that purchases of two Applebee's properties in the Triad region were investments, as the spaces were leased long-term to the restaurants. The Mommy Nora's building is a single story and measures around 3,200 square feet. It's known in the area for its bright yellow exterior paint job. The building was built in 1993, according to Wake County property records. Mommy Nora's first opened in Durham in 2007. The brand was started by Nora Palma, an immigrant from El Salvador, her husband, an immigrant from Peru, and her two children, Ranbir and Ruby Bakshi. The brand was one of the first to serve Peruvian and Latin-style chicken in the Triangle. It eventually grew to four locations in the region before Palma retired in 2015. The Bakshi siblings then took over the business and rebranded three of the four restaurants to Alpaca Chicken. The remaining restaurant, the Wake Forest Road location, kept the Mommy Nora's name and was sold. Lowe's Foods is opening first Pittsboro store near Chatham Park. Pittsboro is getting its first Lowe's Foods grocery store when the Winston-Salem company opens a new store at 65 Ramser Road this month. The store is located in front of Northwood High School along Highway 15501 in the Northwood Landing development. It's across the street from Mosaic at Chatham Park. Lowe's Foods President Tim Lowe will hold the ribbon cutting June 29. Northwood Landing is slated to feature over 300 apartments and 300,000 square feet of retail space. The project is being developed by Kirk Bradley and Lee Moore Capital Company. Plans show space for several outparcel buildings and an automotive dealership or a big box retail store. British Pub falls into bankruptcy. The entity behind the London Bridge Pub has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The pub, also known as The Bridge, is a top spot for watching European soccer matches and grabbing a pint. The pub's owner, Michael Ruiz, says the reason for the bankruptcy is to restructure the company's debt. The business will operate business as usual. Nothing will change from that aspect, he says. The Bridge is located at 110 East Harget Street and opened in 2011. The bankruptcy filing lists 40 and Holding LLC as the debtor, with the London Bridge Pub as its business name. Ruiz is listed as the owner of the LLC. And finally, an upscale barber coming to Fenton. Another tenant is opening in Fenton in Cary. The Boardroom Styling Lounge offers men's grooming services and will open June 26 beside Our Hoss and across from Sports and Social. The company has 46 locations across the country, including one in Midtown Raleigh. The Cary location will feature leather seating, flat screen TVs, and complimentary beer for customers. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Kaylee Thompson. Former farmland on the market in Apex. Prime site is near the planned $3 billion Viridia development. Nearly 50 acres across from a huge development site in Apex is going up for sale. The parcel at 1306 Tingen Road, north of Highway 1 and across the road from the planned 1,067-acre Viridia mixed-use development, is 48.79 acres and owned by the Martin family, who previously owned the South Hills Mall in Cary. Martin Properties President and CEO Donna Martin Evenson says the company prefers to hold on to income-producing properties. It started selling off undeveloped land in 2021. The Tingen Road property is undeveloped, having previously been farmland before David Martin acquired it in 1997 for $717,000. The land is being marketed without a listing price. It has an assessed value of approximately $1.4 million. Foundry Commercial Partner Carl Hudson and Senior Vice President Sarah Godwin are the brokers for the property. Godwin says they're looking to work with a buyer who will develop a project that lines up with the town's future land use plan and new overlay of transit-oriented development. This would mean potentially a development that is employment-focused along with a residential component. The site will likely support more than $160 million of future development, Godwin says. The property will need to be rezoned as it is currently zoned residential agriculture. The owners are willing to work with buyers to go through the rezoning process with the town. Bob Dascom, general property manager for Martin Property, says the company is looking to sell the land outright and not as a partnership. Over the years, the family has been approached by various parties looking to buy the land, but Dascom says the offers have always been underwhelming or not the right fit. This area of Apex doesn't have town sewer services. Property owners have tried to get the town to bring sewer services for more than 20 years. According to Godwin, that will soon be a reality, which will lend to hundreds of acres being ready for development. More missing middle housing coming to Raleigh neighborhoods. Redeeming Development Group has filed subdivision plans for Scales Townhomes in the Five Points area and Farmgate Townhomes in West Raleigh on the border with Cary. Each community is a residential zoning that allows for townhomes without having to rezone the properties due to the missing middle text changes the City Council passed in 2021. In Five Points, Scales Townhomes will have 10 townhomes on a 0.71-acre lot at 1424 Scale Street. The 2,400 to 2,600 square foot townhomes will be three stories with rooftop terraces. The price will be around $900,000, according to Coburn Murray, co-founder of Redeeming Development Group. In West Raleigh, Farmgate Townhomes calls for 25 units. The townhomes will be two stories and range from 1,700 to 1,850 square feet. Prices will start in the mid 400,000s, Murray says. In our last article on this page, New York firm marks Roseville for apartments. A real estate firm from New York is looking to develop apartments and repurpose a historic home into retail in a town in northeast Wake County. KDM Development Corporation has filed a new rezoning application and preliminary site plan for Scarborough Apartments on Main Street in Roseville. The company is asking for it to be rezoned to allow for up to 250 multifamily units and a commercial component. The current zoning is residential low district. The new zoning would be for town center. And our last reporter page is on Greater Triangle, written by Uma Bhatt. LA Group pays $11 million for Pinehurst Marriott. Beccaria Partners plans to spend $4.5 million for renovation of property. A Marriott brand hotel in Pinehurst is under new ownership. The Spring Hill Suites Pinehurst Southern Pines, located along U.S. 15501, sold for $11.7 million, according to a deed filed June 12. The buyer is Hotel Pinehurst LLC, whose registered agent is Los Angeles-based investor Mark Beccaria. Beccaria is a partner with Beccaria Partners, a family business that started with hotels more than four decades ago. The group has purchased multiple properties in places including Kirkland, Washington, Elmhurst, Illinois, and Tucson, Arizona. Beccaria says the group plans to do a significant renovation of the hotel. The total renovation will cost $4.5 million, he says, which is about $42,000 per room for the 107-room hotel. It's going to be a complete remodel of the guest rooms, he says, from removing the popcorn ceilings to all the furniture to converting some of the bathrooms to some of the public space to the exterior. Beccaria said the project timeline of the renovation is within the next year and that the hotel is staying with Marriott through the license. No employees will be affected by the transition, Beccaria says. We've retained Concord Hospitality, which is headquartered in Raleigh, to manage the asset for us, he adds. Beccaria says Beccaria Partners was looking to diversify its portfolio. The Pinehurst Hotel is Beccaria Partners' first East Coast acquisition. We think that Pinehurst is a growing market and we're excited to acquire it, he says. The Sandhills recently ranked as one of the top micropolitan areas in the country and is home to elite golf venues such as Pinehurst Resort, and commercial development is taking off along Highway 501. And the other article on this page, project swells to 1,000 plus homes. A large housing development in Sanford is getting bigger after the city council approved the developer's rezoning request to add more land to the project. Mark Liskowski, an active developer in Lee and Chatham counties, in May requested to rezone 53 acres along Collin Road, C-O-L-O-N, south of Highway 421 to build more single-family homes. Plans call for 197 homes with 6,000-square-foot lots. The city council approved the rezoning during its meeting June 6. The project will fold into the Midtown Village South residential development proposed last year. The plans for Midtown South call for up to 905 new homes, and with this addition, the development could have more than 1,000 homes at full build-out. Liskowski says the lot size of the homes in the new section would be similar to the first section of Midtown Village South. He says he's in the process of getting entitlements done so someone else can develop the land. The current sale of the project is supposed to happen around October, he says. He declines to disclose the buyer. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, High Mortgage Rates Spell Lending Misbehavior. On June 20, I got a report from the Mortgage Bankers Association on the latest loan monitoring survey that represents 66% of the first mortgage servicing market, or 32.8 million loans. The report found that the total number of loans in forbearance decreased by 2 basis points in May to less than 0.5%. According to the MBA, about 245,000 are in forbearance plans, and servicers have provided forbearance to almost 8 million borrowers since 2020. To understand the context of that 0.5% in forbearance last month, one has to look back about 3 years ago in May of 2020, when the Ginny Mae forbearance rate was 11.83%. What does this tell us? It shows that People who own homes may be struggling a little less with their mortgages, especially with a strong labor market and average wages up quite a bit just in the past year. But clearly, there are some strong headwinds facing the housing industry, and it all starts with the mortgage rates currently floating in the market and the tolerance of the U.S. consumer to feel secure that they will be able to pay their mortgages on time every month. What has made matters worse is the rental rates in many of the metros, such as the Triangle, Charlotte, and Nashville, Tennessee, have skyrocketed as well, stressing out renters who are spending a larger chunk of their earnings on assets they don't own. With existing homes for sale inventory at record lows, this is a good time for home builders who have turned on the spigot to build new homes for people who can afford it at higher margins. But it's also a good time for the financing world because of the opportunity to invent new financing tools by promising the consumer lower mortgage payments. And it looks like that trend has started. Currently, one of the most searched keywords on Google is 40-year mortgage. Why is a 40-year mortgage appealing? Because it lowers the monthly payment on a house when compared to a 30-year fixed loan. But what lenders who provide this option for prospective homebuyers may not say is borrowers often may pay as much as 50% more on interest payments by adding 10 years to the mortgage. That, in return, generates very slow equity for the homeowner over time. In a sense, it's like a rental, even if they own the house, with the only equity being their down payment. Sure, one could refinance their loan when rates come down appreciably, but looking at the mood of the Federal Reserve regarding key interest rates, does anyone believe mortgage rates will drop 3 or 4 percentage points in the next 3 to 5 years? To be clear, the Fed does not set mortgage rates, but its action often influences mortgage rates as borrowing becomes more expensive. Already, more lenders have emerged on the market offering the 40-year option, claiming the new method allows more people to own homes. Again, it's the fine print that needs attention. The other trend emerging in big metros and slowly filtering down in the middle metros are the adjustable rate mortgages, where the borrower only pays the interest for the first few years, again, to keep the monthly payments down. But sooner or later, they will be faced with a mortgage bill they will not be able to pay. For details, read up on any housing finance story in early 2009 during the Great Recession. These are both the good times and bad times in housing. And all of this is playing out at a time when the economy is strong, Wall Street is still soaring, and companies are hiring. The environment can be unimaginable if we had had a deep recession with these kinds of mortgage financing methods rampant across America. Beware and be cautious. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Executive Voice Q&A column. And this one concerns Jeff Cox. The headline, he brings a new vision to system. Jeff Cox hopes to see more collaboration across the community colleges. And the interview is done by Zach Ezone. Jeff Cox began his run as president of the North Carolina Community College System on June 1. His appointment to the position follows a nearly 30-year career in education, which spans multiple roles at the K-12 level and about 9 years as president of Wilkes Community College. Under his leadership, the college improved its completion rate from 25% to 55% over a 5-year period. Since Scott Rawls left the president's role in 2015 after a 7-year run, the system's leadership has been marked by turnover. Peter Hahn succeeded Rawls and left for the University of North Carolina system. He eventually was replaced by Thomas Stith, who lasted only 18 months. Cox replaces interim Bill Carver. In this new role, Cox is thinking about how the state's 58 community colleges can operate collaboratively and more efficiently in preparing a workforce as companies continue to move to and invest in North Carolina. But achieving this goal may require an overhaul to a decades-old funding model. What led you to this position? My background for 20 years had been K-12. I never thought about community college, but when I started thinking about economic impact, I've seen the impact of community colleges on individuals. I thought this is really at the heart of what education is all about, giving people that opportunity to get out and have a better life. I applied for the position to lead Wilkes Community College, and lo and behold, they hired me for the job. I stayed in that role for almost 9 years. During those 9 years, I've seen a lot of transition at the system level. Out in the colleges, the sense has been that turnover had a challenging effect on our community college system. So my wife and I said, you know, what the system really needs is a current president to come in and understand the role of the system president in the context of how it's similar to and different than being the president of a thriving college out in the system. What do you make of the turnover at this position? It's a complex role. A lot of different stakeholders who are engaged and interested in the work that's going on in our community college system. I think all of our elected leaders know what a vital role our colleges play, so there's a lot of pressure that comes along with making sure we're getting it right for folks. Why were you interested in the job? There's a lot I don't know, but one strength that I've had over the years is building a strong team. At Wilkes, I inherited a good team, but over the years, that team has changed some, and we continued to build and strengthen that team. We had a lot of success at Wilkes. It wasn't my doing, but it was through building a team that could figure out how to fit all the right pieces together and make progress. As I've reflected on it, that's really what the system needs. How are you approaching this transition? Our system is a little unique in that there is a fair amount of autonomy out there among the 58 presidents. So here, it's broader. It's interacting with the legislature, the governor, and other folks at the state level to try to have an impact on, hopefully, our budget and resources that are available. How does your background in K-12 help? The dual enrollment programs that we have with our K-12 schools have become a significant part of our business. When we look at the state attainment goal of 2 million people with a post-secondary credential by 2030, these students who are in high school and already working on some kind of post-secondary credential are going to play a key role in helping us meet that goal and meet the demands of our business and industry. What do you see as the primary role of the system and its individual colleges? The depth and breadth of what the local community colleges do really couldn't be overstated. Everything from working with typical programs you would expect, two-year degree programs, to all of the college transfer programs. Then we also do basic skills programs for people. Our system's role is providing the support and infrastructure for those 58 colleges, advocating for the state community college budget, about $1.5 billion or so. What are your priorities as system president? Early on, it's getting established and getting any vacant positions that we have filled, certainly getting to know the board members and having more and deeper conversations with the board and our team at the system office about building a shared vision, workforce, and meeting the demands of business and industry. That's emerging as probably the single highest priority. We've got all of these companies that are locating in North Carolina, and they're needing thousands of highly skilled workers. Most of those aren't going to require a bachelor's degree, but it will require some kind of post-secondary credential, at least a short-term credential, and that's our wheelhouse. What are the primary challenges facing the system and community colleges? We've got to look at our capacity to do what it is that we want to do, which is really to be able to be responsive to the needs of our business and industry across the state, and to be the main portal of entry to higher education for every citizen in North Carolina. To do that, we're going to have to think differently about our financial model. There are places where that system is a bit antiquated and not set up to allow us to be as nimble as we want to be. And along with this article, there's a closer look section, title, President, North Carolina Community College System, hometown, Sparta, age, 54, family, wife, Reba, sons, Dylan, Evan, and Zach, first job, lifeguard, education, bachelor's and master's degrees, Appalachian State University, doctorate, UNC Charlotte, number of schools in system, 58, number of students enrolled in 2021-22, 574,378, and budget, about $1.5 billion. And now we'll read some of the big number sections sprinkled throughout the Triangle Business Journal. The first big number, 172,000. The number of passengers Raleigh-Durham International Airport served on Memorial Day weekend, an increase of 7% from pre-pandemic 2019. $570 million. That's how much Fortrea aims to raise through an offering of senior secured notes. The company, which is setting up its headquarters in Durham, intends to use proceeds to fund a portion of a roughly $1.6 billion cash distribution to LabCorp as part of Fortrea's spinoff as a standalone public company. 23,000. That's how many square feet the newest Trophy Brewing location will have. The Raleigh Brewer purchased a warehouse near the Five Points neighborhood and plans to open a taproom restaurant with the potential for production space. The new spot will be the brand's sixth location. And our last big number is $9.1 million. The amount a prime piece of property in downtown Raleigh near Nash Square sold for to Convexity Properties of Chicago. The 0.66-acre site at 200 West Morgan Street was listed for sale in September 2022 by the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina. And now we'll read some of the he said it or she said it sections sprinkled throughout the Triangle Business Journal. The first quote is from Alex Lassiter, CEO of sustainability platform Green Places of Raleigh, after the firm raised $13 million in a round led by Red Point Ventures. "I'm just having a lot of fun. I could do this for the next 10 years and be really happy. There's so much that we have to accomplish. I would say we're 1% through our ultimate product vision. It's a really fun business." And our second and last quote is from Brandon Snow, executive director at Alley Home. "We've seen two very different housing markets emerge simultaneously, with home prices in the West Coast heading for a decline while East Coast prices are on the rise. And we expect to continue to see a fragmented housing market across the country over the next several months." And in our final minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the Business Pulse survey. The question is, are you worried that artificial intelligence could replace your job? The total number of responses was 138. 54% of the respondents say no. 30% say AI can't replace what I do. And 16% say yes. And we'll leave you with one bonus big number from the article on United Therapeutics, planning to expand an RTP with a $500 million project, and that number is $4 billion. United Therapeutics aims to double its annual revenue, which last year totaled near $2 billion, by the end of 2025. The company's product, Diviso DPI, which it will manufacture at a new facility, is a critical part of United's growth aspirations. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.